viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to literature with Lee and PT. Here at Listening to Literature, we like to examine thought-provoking books of the present and the past. And PT, today we actually have a text that's quite a ways in our past.
We are going back to our past with a vengeance. We are going back to early English and Beowulf.
Now,
wait, Lee.
That's right. And some people might remember having read Beowulf maybe in high school or college. I know for me it was high school, you know, and I won't say how many decades ago it was, but it was a few decades. So that's especially to help me remember what the poem is about. We actually have a special guest in our studio today.
Yay.
Dr. Carol Andrews, who is a very recently retired professor of literature. Carol, how are you today?
Hi, I'm just fine. I'm really delighted to be invited to join you today.
We are so excited to have you here. Now, one of the things that I found out about you when PT and I said, okay, let's look at Beowulf, you actually studied Beowulf in the original language?
I did. It was required in graduate school. It was a year-long course of study. We read some shorter poems, I think, at the beginning, but then we translated Beowulf line by line from the Old English to Modern English. And it was really interesting to me to read Seamus Heaney's translation of it because it moved so fast. When I think of Beowulf, I think of slogging through, you know, looking at word by word by word, and it seems so slow. But it's a remarkable action poem, and so much happens so quickly.
It really is action-packed. I mean, I have sort of the same memory, even though I did not translate it line by line, and don't even ask me to read it in the original. But you're right, when you read one of the translations, and probably some people will claim it's a masterpiece in itself, one of the great translations is by the poet Seamus Heaney. And you're right, when you read his translation, I mean, it's about 3,000 lines long. It's a page-turner.
It really is a page-turner. I was so glad it's the first time I've read that one, and I was so glad to do it. It was interesting to me that when he was talking about it in his introduction, he said that, and he slogged his way through translating. It took him a long time,
and
he has false starts and had a lot of struggles. But he was really pleased to find that he knew Irish, and a lot of the words that he knew in his own language came from the Old English, or were still around.
Right.
Some of his relatives would use some of these words.
Right.
And so in some ways, he felt much more at home doing it than I think he ever expected that he would.
Yeah, and he Seamus Heaney in that introduction sort of talks about once he sort of sees that connection between words that his older relatives had used with him growing up, and then looking back at the poem and this, you know, huge task of translating it. He said it just sort of opened up a new world for him, and he felt like he now could actually translate Beowulf.
And he really captured the sounds of it quite well. One of the things that I've always remembered about Old English poetry and that makes it distinctive is that it uses something called strong stress meter.
Okay.
We're used to things like, well, free verse nowadays, but we're used to sonnets, which has syllable stress meter. There'll be 10 syllables in a line, and five of those will be stressed, and shall I compare thee to a summer's day? But in Old English, it didn't matter how many syllables there were in the line. There would just be four strong stresses across the line. There would be a caesura or a pause in the middle. But if you look at the first lines of Beowulf, it sounds like, and my screen just went away.
Uh-huh. We can help you find it.
I found it.
Okay. PT also has a hard copy as well.
But you can hear that, and my pronunciation is, I'm sure, 40 years terrible. But
it's better than mine.
It starts out, wet weigardena in yer dagum, theod chiniga, thrim yefrunen, who the athlings, Ellen Frimiden, So you hear that there's a pause in the middle of each line. I don't know how well that came across. And then there's two beats, a pause, and then two more beats. And it doesn't matter how many other syllables are there. And you just get used to that. You just fall into that rhythm. And actually, that was part of the movement of it, even trying to struggle through as a student.
It is. Old English had the same almost lyrical tone that some of the modern Scandinavian languages have, and it fits into that beautifully. To me, one of the charms of this particular translation is that it is so beautiful.
It is.
And translating poetry especially can be a big problem. If you're too faithful to the dictionary definition, it gets to be really wooden. I would say that the fact that Heaney was a poet to begin with, absolutely helped him. I'm going to do a little quoting myself.
Right.
I don't know if I have the guts to read the old English.
I certainly don't.
Well, I'll give it a shot. Da cum amore under mist helfenum grando gongen godes yibar. Minte sic manscatha mansis sumne. Well, I'll go on, but de cum of more, coming off the moors, under mist helofthlum, under mists, Grendel gongen, Grendel goes. Godes yibar, Grendel is not beloved of God, and so forth and so on. That's the Old English. According to Heaney, in off the moors, down through the mist bands, God cursed Grendel came greedily loping. The bane of the race men roamed forth, hunting for prey in a high hall.
A beautiful translation, isn't it?
Isn't it?
And Heaney talks about, in his introduction to his translation, about how he did sort of have to balance that line between how closely to adhere to a sort of a strict translation while also ensuring that, as you were saying, Carol, that the poetry comes through, the proper meter, that strong stress. And he does admit that he does, I don't know if I want to use the term, fudge some things here. And
no,
there, but,
he did.
But he fudges them in the name of poetry, and I think in how it should be heard and read. And since the poem, especially post Tolkien, and we can talk about Tolkien later, you know, people have talked about this poem not just as a historical poem, but a work of art.
Yes.
I think you do see that artistry come through in Heaney's translation.
There's also alliteration along with the strong stress, and I just heard it with high hall. He uses the alliteration
right. The way
that the Old English
and
did.
Right. In Old English, alliteration was a great part of their poetry.
Right. Sure.
Well, And there's no way a translation is going to capture that.
Right. Now, Heaney, in his introduction, he gives us an exact example of this, of both what you're talking about, with the strong stress and the alliteration. So here is part of Heaney's translation. The fortunes of war favored Hrothgar. The highest in the land would lend advice and find friendship in the father's embrace.
There you go.
Right.
It has both of those elements.
Right. Now, PT, you had just mentioned something about a Nordic sense. And both Carol and I, again, it's been a decade since I've read this poem. And of course, I remember this poem as an Old English poem. But the events that take place in this poem don't happen in
England.
They happen in basically
somewhere in Denmark.
It's Denmark, Sweden, right around in that region, right?
Right, right. Some castle by the misty moors. But that covers an awful lot of Denmark.
It absolutely does.
I think I'd completely forgotten. It's a Swede going to help a Dane.
Yes.
Yes.
Written
yes.
in Old English.
Right. And technically Beowulf was a, what they
well,
would
Well, he
call,
wasn't a Swede.
He was a Geat.
A Geat.
And that's spelled G-E-A-T.
Yes.
For our Americanized listeners, we would probably say Geat, but it's really probably Geat.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So.
These were people who ruled what is now southern Sweden back then. As a matter of fact, part of Beowulf in the dragon episode is this great feud he had with the Swedes. They had a much different sense of what national identity was than we have now. But at the time in England, they had been invaded by the Danes, and this was not just a Viking raid. This was a full-scale invasion that wound up with the King Canute essentially taking control of England. And, of course, anybody who's Scandinavian laughs at that A in there because that's just Knut.
That's just Knut. And what time period are you talking about here, PT?
We're talking about, well, right around the turn of the century, somewhere in the late 900s, early 1000s.
Right. And so I guess maybe we should back up a little bit. there's been, obviously, over the many, many years, a lot of scholarly debate about when the events depicted in Beowulf, the historical elements, because it's not all historical, took place, and also when the poem was actually written.
And this is one of the reasons I became interested in it, because if there's any way to stir people who are interested in Old English into a frenzy, it's to take a position on Beowulf, because people fight about the provenance, people fight about the manuscript, people fight about the story, people fight about everything.
Right. That's great academic fighting. But of course, we were talking earlier about how Beowulf probably was an oral poem to begin with, and the manuscript, the only manuscript that exists to this day, I believe, they think is dated maybe to, what, 800, 900, 1,000?
Well, 1, no. This is kind of an interesting story, too. In the late 1990s, the British Library gave an American scholar by the name of Kevin Kiernan leave to do a thorough analysis of the script.
Okay, that they have in their possession.
And it is theirs now. And he subjected it to all the normal scientific tests, infrared and so forth and so on, looked at the materials. He's dated it to somewhere between 975 and 1025.
Okay.
And this is based on the age of the materials and some of the other things he looked at. So that's pretty solid now, although people still argue about it. And the second thing he said was that there were two scribes, and the second scribe had made the corrections to the first scribe's work in the part that the first scribe does, and that was interesting. And the third thing he said was this was probably a poem that was written pretty contemporarily to the manuscript. Now, what he meant by that is not that the story is only that recent, but that the particular story that they copied was
recent.
The story definitely is not Anglo-Saxon in origin. It probably... I've seen some estimates of the story going back to 600. I don't know how they figured that out. Could be older, and it was definitely something that was originally sung rather than written. The Scandinavian peoples at the time were much greater at singing than they were writing stuff down.
Right. So and parts of this poem, scholars have said, look, there are historical elements woven into this poem, but also fictional elements as well. As far as we know, Beowulf himself, the hero of this epic poem, is a fictional.
As far as we know, but I'm not sure Grendel is all that historic or the dragon either.
Right. And we can talk. We'll talk about the major movements
in
the poem.
Do that.
But before we do that, Carol. We call this an epic poem. What does that mean?
Well, this is an epic, and it was Tolkien that pointed this out in The Monsters and the Critics. Apparently, before Tolkien...
That was a lecture from 1936 that Tolkien gave.
36, okay. That scholars had mostly been trying to date it and trying to authenticate various parts of it etc. But he talks about it as a work of art. He says it has a beautifully balanced structure. There are three monsters that Beowulf fights.
And three groups of people.
Three groups of people involved. It's imaginative. It's not just folklore or philology. And it's like an epic in that it involves a hero who is involved in great actions. An entire culture is involved. The hero's exploits save a culture. Their distances, their journeys, they celebrate their achievements with banquets, they tell stories, they tell other stories that parallel the events of that are happening in this action.
Poems within the poem.
Poems within poems, and it's a very oral culture, and it is an oral culture. And the minstrel recites... In one place, a minstrel recites a poem in celebration of Beowulf's achievement. So there's sort of a meta quality to it. It's about itself in some ways, too.
Right.
It's very much in the epic tradition.
Right. And Heaney talks about this a little bit in his introduction, but you were actually telling me this as well before we came on air. So Heaney says, look, most Western readers, like, you know, we might not know all of the Iliad or the Odyssey, but we know something about it and the names sound familiar. Heaney says, with this epic story, everything is sort of strange because we don't really understand the locations and we don't really know how to pronounce the names. And you brought up, so J.R.R. Tolkien, and many of our listeners probably know Tolkien, in his lecture from 1936, he kind of talks about how Beowulf helps us understand some of these other epic stories and epic poems. And so I was thinking about, you know, this question of why should anyone be reading Beowulf today? And obviously there are multiple answers to that, not just a great work of art, beautiful poetry, but also that understanding Beowulf's epic might help us understand some of these other great epics. And let me give our listeners just a little taste of what Tolkien said back in 1936. He says, "Let us by all means esteem the old heroes, men caught in the chains of circumstance or of their own character, torn between duties equally sacred, dying with their backs to the wall. But Beowulf, I fancy, plays a larger part than is recognized in helping us to esteem them." And then Tolkien goes on and contrasts a little bit about Beowulf versus some of these other epics that we might be more familiar with. He says, "Beowulf is not the hero of an heroic lay, precisely. He has no enmeshed loyalties nor hapless love. He is a man, and that for him and many is sufficient tragedy." So it seems like Tolkien...
That's beautiful.
Yeah, really kind of laid out... several of the reasons as to why Beowulf is so important to read and enjoy then and now, even.
And Heaney continues that with the point he makes about it. He says that as he was translating it, he realized that it's always in the indicative mood. It's these things just are happening. And there is a kind of undiluted quality about it.
Mm.
And he was sort of thrilled to find that a word that I think one of his grandmother perhaps had used, the word thole, which means to suffer, that was still in the language that he learned when he was young, but that there is suffering in life and we have to deal with it and it happens. And there is sort of a matter of fact acceptance of that in this poem that we do kind of still need.
Right. And I think that sort of sums up what Tolkien was saying quite a bit.
It's remarkable.
It pops up in a lot of Scandinavian literature.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The other thing, too, though, Lee, the Iliad provides us with a tremendous amount of insight about the Greek people at the time, not just how they looked and what their ships looked like and all the rest of that, but how they thought. I think that Beowulf provides us with the same feeling both about the Anglo-Saxons and about the Viking types, right, that this poem was written about.
And these earlier warrior cultures, Right. And Heaney delves into that a little bit in his introduction. And we're almost at our midpoint. And so we'll maybe lay this out a little bit, and then we'll take a quick break for station identification and a few announcements, and then come back and talk about the actual narrative and that action of Beowulf that, Carol, you were referencing earlier. That these different warrior cultures or warrior groups that the poem references and the poem is about, it's a much different culture than, say, the culture of the poet himself. We don't know who it was, or maybe two poets, right? But that poet was coming more from a Christian-based culture, whereas the events of the poem are about a very, very different cultures.
Absolutely, but still a monk or whatever, of very much familiar with the sort of thing that was happening in the poem.
Right. And one of the things I do love about the poem, and I can't remember where I read this, so I apologize. The author was saying that, look, the poem starts in media res, right, in the middle of things.
That's what an epic does.
Is that what an epic does?
Oh,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
And that the poem is capped at the beginning and end by funerals. It opens with the funeral of a great king, right? And is that a Danish king, right?
Right.
And then, of course, it ends, and we'll talk about whose funeral it ends
maybe
after the break. So let's take a quick break for station identification and a few announcements. And when we come back here on Listening to Literature, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Carol Andrews, professor of literature, about the poem Beowulf.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul. This portion of WRUU-LP, Savannah Soundings programming, is brought to you by listeners and by the Savannah Jazz Festival, which brings jazz and blues to Forsyth Park and other locations around Savannah from September 22nd to the 28th. The Savannah Jazz Festival is presented by the Coastal Jazz Association with investment from the City of Savannah. Evening concerts followed by nightly jam sessions bring artists such as Dolette McDonald, The Huntertones, Big Sam's Funky Nation, Vanessa Rubin, and Annette Cohen to Savannah. For more information, go to savannahjazzfest.com.
WRUU 107.5 FM is a new and different listener-supported and all-volunteer community radio station for Savannah. Our diverse broadcast and web programming is supported by generous listeners who value our passion and spunk. We are independent of other media and receive no government or large corporate support. People like you are our largest and most important source of our funding. Go to WRUU.org to find out how you can make a one-time or a monthly contribution. Thank you.
Tonight on WRUU, tune in at 7 for Feel the Darkness, Underground, Punk, and Hardcore. At 8, Let's See Who My Friends Are interviews ordinary people sharing their stories. At 9, Soul Sensations features R&B through the decades. At 10, the Savannah Music Festival Live brings you music recorded at the Savannah Music Festival. And at 11, we bring you 2 hours of Friday night dance music. Our latest schedule is always at WRUU.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature with Lee and PT. Today we have Dr. Carol Andrews in the studio, a recently retired professor of literature, and we are talking about the old English poem Beowulf. And we're going to get into the narrative and the story of Beowulf. But Carol, one of the things that you had, I learned from you just today, we'll talk a little bit more about the language before we go into the story, that in this poem, there's it uses a lot of compounds, or there's compound words. Can you tell us a little bit about what are these compound words and give us some examples?
Yes, it's one of the most delightful aspects of Old English poetry. They're sort of hyphenated two-word metaphors or analogies, and they're called kennings. And I just remember some of them. They have stayed with me for a long time. There's the Hron Road, which is the whale road, and that's the ocean. I've also heard it called the Swan's Way, and that's interesting because, as you pointed out, Proust used that in his Remembrance of Things Past. You have Ring Giver, you have the Mead Hall, you have Treasure Giver, People's Shield. These are would be names for a king, someone who looked after his people. So these hyphenated kennings are part of the richness of the language.
Right.
But it's a very compact sort of figurative language, though.
It is. Old English as a language has much less breadth and much less flexibility than modern English. So they did the portmanteaus that you're talking about, and it still comes off as very vigorous and lovely.
Right. Yes, both of those things. And imaginative.
And imaginative. And imaginative.
I mean, who would have think of the ocean as the whale road?
I love that as well. I think that's how I'm going to refer to it from here on out. the dolphin path for a river, maybe. I don't know. I think, of the Savannah River, just not too far from us here.
Oh.
I don't know.
That's good.
So you had also mentioned a little bit earlier, Carol, that the whole epic poem is basically about three events or three agons, or three peoples, the Swedes, the Geats, and the Danes. But what are the three events in the poem?
Well, there is the attack on the Mead Hall by Grendel, this monster, and it's always been a little nebulous in my mind what Grendel is supposed to look like, but he's very strong. And we were trying to, you asked me why he did it, and we were looking at the background, and there are Christian elements in this poem that have been imposed on the earlier pagan stories. And he is to be thought of as one of the monsters that were exiled by God after Cain's murder of Abel.
Okay.
And apparently in the poem, it actually, in the translation, it's much more vivid. He just gets tired of being exiled to this swamp or cave or mud hole that he's in. And he's just mad about it, and he goes to get some vengeance. And so that's why he goes and terrorizes the people, the men in the Mead Hall. And then after Beowulf fights with him and defeats him, we can talk in more detail about how he does it, his mother comes, Grendel's mother comes for vengeance on her son. And
because Beowulf has killed Grendel.
Beowulf has killed Grendel. And then Beowulf has to follow her to her lair, and they fight under the water. Beowulf is a very strong swimmer. And then he's rid the land of these two monsters, and he goes back to Sweden and rules very well for 50 years.
He becomes the king of his people, rules for 50 years, a very comfortable, peaceful existence.
And then his people are attacked by a dragon who has had something valuable stolen from his hoard of treasure. And Beowulf knows that it's his duty to defend the people one more time.
Right.
But there's a different tone to that. It's much more elegiac, and he's not a young man anymore.
Right.
And he kind of knows this is going to be his last fight, even as he engages in it.
Yeah.
And so we have an element of elegy that comes into that.
And Heaney talks about there's a sense of fate
throughout
the whole poem. And once we get to it, hopefully we'll have time to get to it, even within the poem itself and within the translation, Beowulf even recognizes this sort of unknowable but certain fate that he's about to face.
The old English word was wind, W-Y-N-D.
Okay.
And it's just sort of the wheel of necessity that they accepted.
Right, right. I believe Heaney explains it. He talks about these two tracks or two paths. You have they said warrior culture going through the poem on one hand, and then a Christian elements as well. And Heaney was saying, hey, look, Beowulf and the peoples around Beowulf, they didn't think about this eternity in heaven. Right. What they did is it's what you accomplish, the glory through your actions, glory through war. And so it's interesting how the poem kind of weaves both of them together.
It does, and I think there are certain places where you can start to see the pre-Christian element of the origin of the poem in those. One of those threads, anyway.
Right, right. I don't know which agon or which event or battle do we want to talk about. Should we talk a little bit about the battle with Grendel, or do we want to focus about the battle with Grendel's mother? And then
let's do a little bit about all three.
I think so.
They all have their really cool thing.
They really,
and how is Grendel killed?
I want to warn listeners that if they choose not to listen to us today, mm-hmm. There was a movie made a few years back of Beowulf, and it is, well, it's not that well regarded in my house anyway. There are people in my house who think that Grendel's mother probably didn't look anything like Angelina Jolie.
Probably not.
And they kind of overemphasized the action element here, but one thing I would like to mention, because we've kind of almost accused Heaney of fudging, and sometimes he did and sometimes he didn't, the opening word, hoyt.
Oh, yes. What a great story behind this.
Is an exclamation, and it's been translated in any number of different ways. Hark, or
low,
listen up.
Yes.
Or, and if you go back to some of the academic texts, and I'm looking at Klaber here, he says, well, that it was an exclamation, but it was a soft exclamation.
Okay.
It wasn't meant to alarm people. Heaney starts off with so.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Here's the story.
Which is very contemporary.
And very contemporary.
It really is.
But also completely in line with what Klaber is saying.
Right. Absolutely. So
But that's only
continue.
The opening word, and we want to talk about episodes.
Yeah. So the battle against Grendel, right? And of course, you know, Grendel has come to the Danish king's mead hall and has wreaked havoc, right? You know, so after nightfall, Grendel set out for the lofty house to see how the ring Danes were settling into it after their drink. And there he came upon them, a company of the best asleep from their feasting, insensible to pain and human sorrow. Suddenly then the god-cursed brute was creating havoc. Greedy and grim, he grabbed 30 men from their resting places and rushed to his lair, flushed up and inflamed from the raid, blundering back with the butchered corpses. Right. So this is the original attack by Grendel, and now, of course, Beowulf and his fellow soldiers need to come together to seek revenge.
I love the alliteration of that passage you just read.
Yeah, I'm sorry I did mess up the ending, because that's great.
No,
blundering back with the butchered corpses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how does Beowulf confront Grendel?
Well, he sets a trap for Grendel. I should point out here that the Scandinavians at the time lived in longhouses.
Right.
So this was not only the mead hall, it was probably the residence of some of these people. So he and his geats feigned sleep in the hall, and, well, actually they all fell asleep but Beowulf. And Beowulf heard Grendel coming and grabs him by the arm and wakes the others. They try to stab Grendel, but their edged weapons can't penetrate his skin. And so it turns into a one-on-one battle between Grendel the monster and Beowulf, who has the strength of, what is it, 32 people in his hands? I forgot.
I don't remember how many, but he
very
much
lots
counts
lots
on
of
his
people
strength,
anyway.
His arm strength.
Yeah, and Beowulf's strength comes in very handy when it in the next episode, but we'll get to that. And Grendel, I had read a passage of Heaney's translation about the first attack, but Grendel had kept attacking them, right? It wasn't just, I think, one attack.
Right.
I think there was multiple attacks.
He was a menace.
He was a menace, right?
And again, this was a residence, so presumably it had women and children as well as men.
That's right. Interesting.
Right.
But that it's described very graphically, the way that Beowulf manages to tear off the arm of Grendel, and Grendel, wounded, goes back to his lair. But it doesn't pull any punches. It's a very grim scene of the fight. Were you going to read some of the?
I was trying to find that section of the fight, and I can't seem to find my highlights here. I have it where Beowulf is. I believe valiant, and then the minstrel is going to sing about his valiancy. Maybe PT, you can find the excerpt there in your translation. So we're all sitting here flipping through our copies of Beowulf.
Let's start here.
What line are you on?
I am around. I am about 7:40.
That's where I am as well. Okay.
Okay. We're talking about Grendel here. He grabbed and mauled a man on his bench, bit into his bone lappings, bolted down his blood, and gorged him on him in lumps, leaving the body utterly lifeless, eaten up, hand and foot. Venturing closer, his talon was raised to attack Beowulf, where he lay on his bed. He was bearing in with open claw when the alert hero's comeback and armlock forestalled him utterly. The captain of evil discovered himself in a hand grip harder than anything he had ever encountered in any man on the face of the earth. Every bone in his body quailed and recoiled, but he could not escape. He was desperate to flee to his den and hide with the devil's litter, for in all his days he had never been clamped or cornered by like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Carol, you were talking earlier about how action-filled and engaging this poem is. I think listeners can get a sense of that just in that passage.
And I think what's interesting, we talked about this briefly, you get some of the same graphic sense in the Iliad as well.
Very much so.
Yes.
Very much so.
In the battles there.
Right. And with Grendel now, you know, vanquished, right, well, you have family members of Grendel who might not be so pleased about Grendel's vanquishing. And so the next big struggle that comes into the poem is the revenge that Grendel's mother seeks, right, to avenge his son. And Carol, I had asked you earlier, I said, it bothers me a little bit that we don't have a name for Grendel's mother. She's just Grendel's mother.
Well, I was noticing, if you look at some of the genealogies, the queens even don't have names, unless they were very, very beloved or very powerful in a kind of evil way. Beowulf's mother doesn't have a name in the genealogy.
Right. But Beowulf's father does.
She's, I guess that's her role in life, and that's what she's known as.
And she's even sort of more ferocious than Grendel himself.
Well, yeah, you don't mess with the mother.
That's right.
You don't.
And I think that was the point.
Right. And one of the other things that Heaney points out is not only sort of the three episodes, the three struggles and the three peoples, but also sort of these three places of fear, psychic fear that you see over and over again in world art everywhere. And one of these places is where Grendel's mother is, right? In a lair at the bottom of a very deep lake, right?
Right.
And again, Beowulf is a strong swimmer.
Right.
I mean, this is
he fights off monsters as he's swimming down to get to her lair, so he can go basically, you know, deliver the retribution for the revenge that she has taken out on these peoples for killing Grendel. And man, that battle between Beowulf and Grendel's mother in her underground lair is also just fascinating.
It's a more complicated battle.
It's more complicated.
Very much
you were explaining earlier the weapons that why there were weapons down there.
Right.
This one involves weapons.
Right.
But there are only certain weapons that can kill her, or a certain weapon.
Right, that's true. I was saying that I envision her lair as being kind of sort of like a Viking longhouse. And there would be well-known weapons or weapons of ancestors on the walls, hang on the walls as decoration.
Right.
And in this particular case, she had the swords of giants.
In her lair. Right.
And unfortunately, she ran across a foe who had the strength of 32 or whatever it was, men in his hands, and so could wield one of these, whereas the weapon he brought with him was perfectly useless against her.
It was useless against her, and at one point she's basically besting him. She has him pinned, but because, like you said, Beowulf can lift this giant sword, that's how he eventually triumphs. So this is sort of the beginning of that battle after Beowulf has dived down into the water. After these words, the prince of the weather, Geats, there's another one of those compounds in there, right, Carol, was impatient to be away and plunged suddenly. Without more ado, he dived into the heaving depths of the lake. It was the best part of a day before he could see the solid bottom. Quickly, the one who haunted those waters, who had scavenged and gone her gluttonous rounds for 100 seasons, sensed a human observing her outlandish lair from above. So she lunged and clutched and managed to catch him in her brutal grip. But his body, for all that, remained unscathed. The mesh of his chainmail saved him on the outside. Her savage talons failed to rip the web of his war shirt. Then once she touched bottom, that wolfish swimmer carried the ring-mailed prince to her court, so that for all his courage, he could never use the weapons he carried. And a bewildering horde came at him from the depths, droves of sea beasts who attacked with tusks and tore at his chainmail in a ghastly onslaught. The gallant man could see he had entered some hellish turnhole, and yet the water did not work against him, because the hull roofing held off the force of the current. Then he saw firelight, a gleam and flare-up, a glimmer of brightness. So that's the beginning of the battle with Grendel's mother. Right. So he eventually succeeds in killing Grendel's mother. And like you said, Carol, it's a more complex and a more ferocious battle than the original battle. And then we get some more minstrel singing and some more poems within poems.
Have another party.
Yeah, and another feast, right?
You have to celebrate.
You have to celebrate. And then, of course, the last, you know, major act is Beowulf's having to come out of, you know, kind of retirement 50 years later and battle this dragon. I think, Carol, you had mentioned it earlier. Why was the dragon upset? Why did the dragon...
Someone had stolen some treasure from his hoard.
Like a golden chalice.
Oh, another kenning is that I remember from somewhere. They were always talking about unpacking one's word hoard.
Yes, word hoard.
To tell a story or to make a speech.
Ah.
But that was how riches were kept. They were one's hoard, and it was a collection. And some just ordinary, you know, enterprising thief took something. The dragon was asleep and he took something, and the dragon came out in revenge. And as soon as Beowulf heard about it, he knew that this was going to be his duty once more to defend his people, and it was going to probably be his last battle, because he had, you know, already been king for 50 years.
Right.
It's a long time. He's in his 70s, 80s. I don't know how old he would have been.
Right. So much so that one of his retainers refuses his order to stay out of it.
Yes, Wiglaf. Right.
So Wiglaf comes to help
Beowulf,
him. Yes.
Beowulf tells all of his soldiers, look, let me go fight this alone, because like you say, Carol, he knows that this is his fate. He knows, and he has a sense of maybe what's coming. And he says to all of his other soldiers, stay out, let me go do this alone. But one of them, Wiglaf, decides to come with him.
Mm-hmm. And the sense of weird, W-Y-R-D,
or yes,
fate, the wheel of necessity, the code of loyalty and bravery. You have to go,
right,
even if you know that it is not going to have probably a positive outcome.
And I think that is the root of our word, weird, W-E-I-R-D, strangeness.
I think it might be.
I think so, right? We'd have to look that up again. But I'm looking back in Heaney's translation here. Carol, you were talking about those compound words. There's a reference here to the horde guardian, and I'm assuming that means the dragon.
Right. Yes, that's the dragon.
Right. And the dragon is in turmoil because as he is awoken, he realizes that one of his treasures has been taken. And you're right, it was a very cunning thief because somehow this thief managed to come in and remove that treasure without even, you know,
Waking the dragon.
So you were talking about Beowulf knowing his fate. And very far down into the poem, we're around line 2415, so 2,500 lines into the poem. The veteran king sat down on the cliff top. He wished good luck to the Geats who had shared his hearth and his gold. He was sad at heart, unsettled yet ready, sensing his death. His fate hovered near, unknowable but certain. It would soon claim his coffered soul, part him from limb. Before long, the prince's spirit would spin free from his body. And this is his sense of knowing what's probably going to come even before he goes into battle. His forebodings, as Heaney puts in the side here. That's the other thing I really like about Heaney's translation. Heaney gives you some little marks in the side about here's what's happening in the story, or here's what some of the characters might be thinking or feeling. And one of my other favorite parts of this poem is, I guess, what has been called the father's lament, about an elder who lost his son to an accidental killing. And this comes right after that passage I had just read about Beowulf sensing his fate. And the father's lament, I don't know if we have time, we might get into it, but it's a beautiful, beautiful passage that still resonates, I think, with people today. Like you said, Carol, in many ways, this is a very modern, modern poem. Yeah. Universal themes, cross-cultural themes. Right, like the lament of a parent who has lost a child.
I think start with mourning after mourning.
Right. So this is about the father who has lost his child. Morning after morning, he wakes to remember that his child is gone. He has no interest in living on until another heir is born in the hall, now that his firstborn has entered death's dominion forever. He gazes sorrowfully at his son's dwelling, the banquet hall bereft of all delight, the wind-swept hearthstone. The horsemen are sleeping, the warriors underground. What was is no more. No tunes from the harp, no cheer raised in the yard. Along with his longing, he lies down on his bed and sings a lament. Everything seems too large, the steadings and the fields. It's breathtaking, isn't
gorgeous.
It? Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. So we have about 5 minutes until the top of the hour at 1 p.m. You can listen to Not Fade Away, usually with Tim Hogenboom, but sitting in for Tim today is Brian Renner, so stick around for that. So 5 minutes left.
Okay. How about I give an unsolicited puff?
All right. Let's hear it, PT.
As I said, Professor Kiernan did this a wonderful study of Beowulf in the early 90s and has been publishing updates ever since. And he used to put out CDs with all of his findings and pictures of the actual manuscript and so forth. But lately he's just put it on a website. And the website is at ebeowulf.uky for University of Kentucky .edu.
Okay, great.
And there's a lot of really, really nice stuff in there. I recommend if you're interested in Beowulf and especially the manuscript at all, that would be a wonderful place to start. Dr. Kiernan has gone on to do the same sort of study on some other of the manuscripts
as well. And P.T., you have a couple of books that you brought with you here. We do have Heaney's translation.
I do.
I don't know if you want to mention
what you like or dislike about the others. The book where Dr. Kiernan documents his conclusions. It's called Beowulf and the Beowulf Manuscript. It was actually published not by the University of Kentucky, but by the British Library and the University of Michigan. Right. So there's that.
And is that relatively new? I can't remember what the date is on that.
Not real. I think 1992 would be the
But the time. The Kentucky website might have some more up-to-date findings.
The Kentucky website would certainly have everything. And this 1996 is the published date of that.
Okay.
And then, of course, there is Kleber's Beowulf, which has been the standard version of how to look at Beowulf before Kiernan. It contains a lot of information about where words came from, what words might connect with one culture or another culture, and so forth and so on. What I'm looking at is the fourth edition of Kleber's, which is edited by R.D. Falk, Robert E. Bjork, and John D. Niles.
What was the original publication date of that?
Oh, well, let me see if I can find it. It's been around, well, he died in 1954. We know that. The particular edition I have is from the University of Toronto Press. And I'm looking for a publication date, not finding one, which is kind of strange.
That's okay. No, yeah, we'll keep looking for that.
1950.
1950. Okay. And also, we have about a minute and a half left for our listeners who might be interested in Seamus Heaney. Of course, you know, some people have claimed he is the most well-known poet. So if you don't know Seamus Heaney, maybe, you know, you might want to read a little bit about him. He did win the Nobel Prize for Literature back in the 90s, I believe. And one of the very interesting things, we don't have time to go into, maybe we'll talk about him on a later date. He said that he realized in translating Beowulf that a lot of his own poetry, even before he began this translation, tended to follow along that strong stress rhythm that, Carol, you were talking about a little bit earlier.
As well as the Scandinavian languages, that's part of Irish,
that's
too.
That's part of Irish as well.
More modern literature uses strong stress than one would think.
Okay.
T.S. Eliot,
yes.
You can find it, Pound. It's interesting.
Fabulous. Well, I really want to thank you, Dr. Carol Andrews, just retired professor of literature. We are hoping to have her back on a regular basis to be maybe one of our scholars in residence to give us some insight into great literature and great writing. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us as well. Good day and good reading.
Bye, y'all.
The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.